This is the takeaway for Monday, June 22nd. Here we go. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And on this Monday, this is a program full of your voices.
This is Darcy from Ohio. Has any other country, following a terrible civil war, allowed for the loser to fly their flag with pride? When will we learn that we are all just humans, no matter our color, and that racism is taught? Feeling malice towards none doesn't mean allowing those who lost to claim nostalgia when acting in a way that should be a slap in the face to all of us, and flying this flag on state grounds seems at worst treasonous and at best ignorant.
The talk about the Confederate flag flying officially in South Carolina filled the conversation over the weekend among politicians, celebrities, average citizens. The flag issue has crystallized the question of how to respond to the shootings last week of 9 African Americans in a church in Charleston, South Carolina, a church that is every bit as symbolic of American civil rights history as the Confederate flag is a symbol of the Confederacy. Here's Stephanie on our Facebook page. Flying the Confederate flag does nothing but create division. It's not helping to bring people together. Having it flying proudly over the state building or anywhere else, one flag, one country. They lost. Get over it. But this isn't one of those simple get over it issues. Even though our next guest believes we need to get beyond the Confederate flag, it will take careful steps, he says, remembering history and understanding the changing politics of the American South. Kareem Creighton is Associate Professor of Law at the University of North Carolina School of Law.
This is in many ways a political issue, and I think that's important to see first of all. South Carolina clearly is a conservative state, and it's a state that is very, I think, closely aligned with its identity as a state with a, quote, Southern history, and part of that is wrapped up in the Civil War. The state capitol still marks the places on which the Union bombshells left marks in the building. So these are things that are heavily wrapped up in, I think, the way in which a lot of people, and frankly, white people in the South, view their identity. South Carolina also is a state that is an evolving one. That is, there are people who are in South Carolina now who are not generations ago traceable to South Carolina. So these transplants are in some ways walking into a conversation that's been going on for years, if not decades. The key to all of this, it seems to me, is that for the first time, I think in a long time, you're hearing Southern white conservatives, people who are aligning themselves typically with Southern identity, saying it's time to rethink this issue. It's become personal. And so it may be that that movement among some conservatives in the state house and the state senate are now going to change, at least to move this issue along. Now, the harder question, and I think really what you're going to start hearing from the African-American community, and certainly liberals as well, is, well, this is one piece of a broader set of considerations that we think the state needs to start making that gave rise to this particular incident, and it was, of course, horrific. But also, and as I think you're hearing a lot from the African-American community, this is a piece of a broader concern that African-Americans aren't really welcome in all of the different ways in which governing happens in the state of South Carolina. And that's just not about political party. It's about race.
All right. That's great. And that is so clear. And let me just let me take a kind of devil's advocate sort of thing
here.
Let's just say I am one of those people who can trace their generations right back to the Civil War. And I say to you, number one, we can talk about racism. We don't have to talk about the flag. Why do we have to talk about the flag before we talk about racism? We've been talking about racism in South Carolina for a long time. Second, I think if you pull that flag down, it says somehow that the flag was the cause of those people dying in Charleston, and you can't make that argument. And number three, does anyone have the ability to prove to me that that flag somehow says that it tolerates murder? Hello?
Well, let's see if we can get at each of those issues. I think the first thing to say, both to the people who say, well, there's no linkage between that flag and murder, and the people who say, in fact, that flag stands for heritage that dates back to the 19th century, it turns out that in most of these states that have adopted this rebel flag, it really did not become prominently used until the 1960s. And that was explicitly done in the wake of Supreme Court decisions like Brown versus Board of Education and a broader national concern about desegregating public accommodations. So African Americans who look at this flag with a particular view come at the issue honest. In Mississippi, which incorporates that flag into its official state flag, didn't do so until the 1950s. And again, it was explicitly done in reaction to Brown versus Board of Education. So taking the flag down is a start. It's certainly not the whole project of dismantling the horrible history that the South has with respect to race. And that's not just slavery, but it's the Jim Crow era of most of the 1900s. It's an important first step. Symbols mean things. And when we talk about, you know, a symbol about the United States flag not being burned, we don't think that we're going to lose our democracy when the flag is lit up abroad, but it stands for a disrespect that I think most of us find abhorrent. And I think for many African Americans, by the way, having grown up in the South and being African American, I can tell you I'm one of them, you view the flag in a particular way that at the very least suggests, you know what, there's something that we have that you aren't welcome to. And I don't think that with the state making even a passing embrace of that symbol, that it does the kind of work of bringing people together, which is, I think, what we all expect people to do when we talk about state-embraced symbols. The last point to make, I guess, is about what we ought to be doing as a broader project. I don't think that anybody would acknowledge that the flag, a piece of cloth, caused anybody to lose their lives. However, we do think that trademarks and branding matter. And what is clear, I've written about this, is that the calling card these days of most hate groups, and in particular neo-Confederate groups, these are people who actually lament the loss of the Confederacy, not the Valiant South and the reenactment of battles. But when you talk about those groups embrace this flag as their call to arms. And it seems to me that when that's the case, if we want to deem this as terrorism, and again, I do, we would not countenance any passing endorsement of those same strategies and those brands. And I think that all of those things put together suggest that notwithstanding what you might think about the historical merit of a flag, you still have to think about the current ways in which that emblem is used in ways that I think a significant part of our population, not just African Americans, but most people who look at the modern era as one that embraces everybody. That flag is not the kind of message the state needs to be embracing. The question, if we're asking where's the place of this flag, the place isn't in a state capitol. The place where it belongs is the museum. What we can't do, I think, is allow people to either confuse it or maybe even celebrate it as a current symbol of what makes us a nation of different people who come together for a common cause.
Kareem Creighton is Associate Professor of Law at the University of North Carolina School of Law. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we're interested in your thoughts about the Confederate flag. Cesar writes, there is freedom of speech, and that means that some people in South Carolina are choosing to use a symbol of racism in a building that should represent all of that state when the flag does not. Al writes on Facebook, censoring through political correctness rather than making changes through the political process is extremely uncomfortable. The decision to take down or leave the flag should be made by those in South Carolina, not by social or traditional media. I'm also uncomfortable with the idea that free speech is only free if you express a widely accepted opinion. Growing up, I always feared censorship from the right wing, but over the years I've learned the left is just as guilty, maybe more so, in that we must censor ourselves. Join the conversation. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Lots to talk about. Just go to thetakeaway.org. A suicide attack on the Afghan parliament in Kabul by the Taliban earlier today left at least 18 people wounded and 6 gunmen killed. A terrible story, but hardly an uncommon one. The blast coincided with a vote to endorse the country's new defense minister, who will have the job of deciding what there is to defend in Afghanistan right now and who will defend it. The defense minister may want to recruit from these 3 child soldiers, part of a part militia, part police force, defending villages in Helmand province from Taliban fighters.
So can you describe what happened recently when the Taliban were very close?
The Taliban threw a hand grenade. As soon as they threw the hand grenade, we started fighting back with PK machine guns, Kalashnikovs, and everything. They shot this tower about 11 times, and that one too.
Were you fighting as well when they attacked?
I was sitting right here, and I started shooting at them.
Do you find it hard to be brave when there's fighting?
Of course. If I lay down my weapon, they will not spare us. They will come after us and kill us. The Taliban killed my father. As long as we are alive, we are not going to spare them our land.
That's Vice correspondent Ben Anderson speaking with three child soldiers ages 10, 12, and 14, holding back the Taliban in Helmand Province. Ben's reporting can be seen in the latest HBO Vice News documentary, Afghanistan After Us. Anderson says you can't see much evidence of the United States military in the land of this country's longest war.
And I spent a lot of time in Marja, which was the scene of the biggest operation of the entire war since the initial invasion. And honestly, the only evidence that I could see that the U.S. had ever been there was, you know, a good tarmac road that went through the middle of the district. That was it. There no other sign whatsoever that the U.S. had been there.
And the idea that the U.S. had some impact on the fabric of society, on the village life, on building institutions, any assessment there?
No evidence whatsoever. I mean, the Afghan security forces drive around in Toyota Corollas, often without uniforms, often with very basic old weapons. Usually the Taliban have better weapons. No evidence that the training had you know, taken root whatsoever.
What were you most surprised about, and can I ask, what were you expecting to see?
You know, I wasn't expecting things to be perfect. I've been traveling to Afghanistan a lot for the last 8 years, but going to Marja, where 30,000 troops almost invaded overall, billions of dollars were spent, I expected some kind of progress, some kind of, you know, Afghan government presence. And instead, I saw an ALP unit, which is effectively a local militia who are on the U.S. payroll. They're supposed to have been become part of the Afghan National Police Force by now. They still haven't. I don't think they will. And this ALP unit were commanded by a 53-year-old grandmother, and her grandchildren were fighting. And the three boys I went out on patrol with were 10, 12, and 14 years old. And they weren't, you know, this wasn't just for show. You could tell they were hardened fighters. They had, you know, the way they handled their guns, the way their fingers were just off the triggers. And the stories they told about very recent fights with the Taliban, you could tell these boys fight often.
Did this militia, did this police force, whatever you want to call it, have any connection with the wider security forces and what we're told about the training by U.S. forces in Afghanistan?
No. The ALP in some areas used to be trained by American special forces. They were nowhere to be seen. This is effectively a local tough family who happened to have been anti-Taliban when the U.S. Marines invaded, so were put on the payroll to try and win their loyalty in the long term. The ALP unit I was with don't have a bad record. Some of the ALP units around Afghanistan have awful records. And, you know, I'm often asked questions about the Taliban and what will happen if the Taliban come back and, you know, will it be the grim days of the late 90s all over again? And I think a big mistake that a lot of people make is to assume that our allies and the Taliban have many ideological differences whatsoever. And often you find there are none.
Yet they're still fighting, and the casualty rate for the Afghan forces is peaking this year.
It was a record highs last year. It's going to be higher again this year. I mean, top 10,000 last year when you include injuries and fatalities. With the security forces, if you add desertion and defection rates as well, the numbers are simply not sustainable. I mean, last year it was something like 90 policemen or soldiers were being killed every week, and I'm sure the numbers are going to be higher this year.
Are the Taliban winning? Is that even a formulation you can make?
You know, before I went on this recent trip, I would say it's kind of a bloody stalemate. It does feel like they're taking ground now, and it does feel like this summer they could take possibly the whole of Helmand Province and other provinces as well. Since I've left, there have been four very big attacks on four district centres in Helmand Province, and it really feels like a place that's on the brink.
Some administration officials and military officials, when they speak before Congress, describe the opium cultivation as a way of gauging the U.S. impact. How would you say that's going right now?
I mean, had one of the U.S.'s goals been to make the opium poppies bloom, it would have been the success story of the entire war. But just like the casualties, almost every year, the latest year has been yet another record harvest. I spent quite a lot of time with some opium farmers in Helmand, and they've got a new seed from India, which they think will allow them to have a triple harvest. This year will probably be the biggest opium harvest anywhere in the history of the world in Afghanistan.
And what do civilians say about the U.S. presence and the U.S. mission? Are they bitter about it? Are they happy about it? Or is it just a kind of a yawn? We, oh, that, it happened. Yeah, right.
They're very bitter about the fact that the U.S. has left, because they feel like the war is now entering its bloodiest phase and the Afghan security forces are nowhere near ready enough to stand up to the Taliban. And the Taliban are resurgent and their influence and power is spreading. And they feel like we, as in the U.S. and the U.K. as well, have left just at the point when we're probably most needed.
And the idea of Afghanistan as a rogue nation that will develop a kind of terrorist outpost to do the same kinds of things that happened leading up to 9/11?
I spent a month in Iraq before I spent a month in Afghanistan this time, and it feels like the conditions are eerily similar. There's such a failed government and so many people are alienated that it's ripe for a group like the Taliban. There is a small ISIS presence in Afghanistan, not huge, but to take huge parts of the country. And certainly, you know, Al-Qaeda sympathizers, there's lots of places they could hide very easily in Afghanistan now.
Ben Anderson, a correspondent for Vice, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
Well, I pulled out of Pittsburgh, rolling down that eastern seaboard.
And someday soon, very soon, the hard road, hands-on feel of truck driving will feel more like this.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. As we've reached 10,000 feet, it is now safe to turn on any approved portable electronic devices you may have brought on board.
Truck driving may soon be more like kicking back in first class as an airline passenger if the self-driving Daimler Highway Pilot system, now being tested in Nevada, catches on. Oh, the system still needs a human to sit there and watch the controls, but the pilot does everything else, according to Derek Rotz, who's one of the engineers who helped develop Daimler's self-driving truck program.
The system called Highway Pilot is actually designed to support the driver with the more mundane tasks of driving down the road. And so the system is really, really envisioned to augment the driver and help him or her be more productive and more alert.
And the driver can sleep while the autopilot is going, or no?
No, the driver should remain alert and be ready to take over the system whenever the system requests it. But once the highway pilot is active and engaged, the driver is able to take his or her foot off the pedal and hands off the steering wheel.
How does that increase the amount of hours that an individual driver or crew can get in the truck?
At this point, we're looking at, you know, maintaining the same level of driving in terms of hours of service. And where we think the benefit really comes in is elevating the profile of the driver to allow them to become more productive and essentially take over more logistics tasks and be more of a fleet manager.
All right. What can the pilot do in terms of what's going on around the truck? Is it watching the lines on the road, the curb? What landmarks does it use to guide itself?
The highway pilot uses both radar technology as well as camera technology. Firstly, the radar is able to look at objects in front of the vehicle, and essentially you're able to maintain a safe following distance behind the vehicles. In addition, there's a stereo camera mounted on the front windshield, which is used to detect the lane markings and basically enable the truck to center itself in the lane.
So the computer is looking at the lane lines, and basically that's the guide for the road, for the lane.
That's correct. So it's basically making calculations and judgments in real time, looking at, you know, the lane markings, looking at what vehicles or objects are ahead, and adjusting the throttle, the brakes, as well as the steering inputs.
And how quickly can it respond to sudden changes in the environment?
Within fractions of a second. For example, if a vehicle cuts in front of you, it will be able to respond anywhere between 10 to 100 milliseconds. And if the vehicle in front slows down, of course, the truck will keep a safe following distance and slow down all the way to coming to complete stop if need be.
Let me tell you about a conversation I saw online about this. And maybe it's, you know, science fiction. But it seems to me you get to a point where the computer has to decide in a certain situation, all right, I can do nothing and I collide with a, you know, school bus of kindergartners. I can put on the brakes and maybe still hit the bus. I can swerve, but there's a big concrete wall over there. And if I do that, there's a extreme likelihood that the driver is going to die and the whole truck is going to be destroyed. How does the computer resolve that dilemma?
I like to point out that, you know, this is not a fully level four autonomous system where a driver does not even have to be present in the vehicle. The driver is very much present in the vehicle. In the event that the driver needs to take over, there's a warning system that comes on board. So imagine it like an alarm clock, if you will, that the displays will start to turn red, they'll start to flash, and you'll hear an audible sound that will inform the driver that they need to regain control. So the algorithm is constantly monitoring the situation.
Derek, thanks so much.
Okay, John, it's a pleasure.
Derek Rotz is one of the engineers that managed the development of Daimler's self-driving trucks, the pilot program that he was just speaking about. Without the absolute need for an alert driver running a big truck, hands on the wheel, feet on the gas, brakes, that sort of thing, is there really a need for the traditional truck driver? Does an upgrade from the highway pilot system to the highway no need for a pilot system mean that 3.5 million professional truck drivers in the U.S. will eventually get their walking papers? No one is expecting that immediately, but writer and blogger Scott Santons explored the implications of a fully self-driving truck fleet and concluded that pretty soon technology is going to pose the question, should there be an unconditional basic income for all Americans?
In the short term, trucking looks good. You know, there'll be good, still middle-class wages, salaries with trucking. But as soon as self-driving trucks really hit, like as soon as it's made legal in all 50 states, you know, so that we can drive from state to state, as soon as there's a federal law passed, then this is going to happen really quickly. And this is going to affect a lot more than truck drivers because there's so much of the economy that's dependent on truck drivers, especially when you're looking at small towns all across the country.
These are middle-class jobs. These are high-paying jobs. And by your scenario, although I suspect it will be a little more staged than maybe you're projecting here, these jobs would essentially vanish on the short-run, long-run truck routes, right?
Yeah, essentially. Yeah, they would vanish. People will say that, oh, we'll just have truck drivers still in all these trucks, and you know they'll be needed there just in case. And what this makes me think of, too, is it's like when we, you know, how we used to have elevator attendants. And that used to be a job. Like, people got paid to be elevator attendants. And then we put buttons in there. Like, how funny would it be if we were still requiring elevator attendants in all of our elevators because we weren't trusted to push the buttons ourselves? That's what it's going to be going towards, is just like a button pusher, as in just in case or whatever kind of situation. I want to make the point, too, that this is actually very exciting to me. Like, I'm not saying that this technology is bad in any way and that we should avoid it. I'm actually on the side that says we should welcome it. It's just that we have to recognize that there are going to be effects, second-order, third-order effects of this stuff, and we have to be prepared for that. And I suggest that we need a basic income in order to do that. But as far as, like, the excitement of trucks, I mean, it can save lives. It's safer. Imagine being able to, say, leave your house at night, go to sleep, and wake up the next day at your destination. Like, you didn't have to drive at all, and it was just, it's almost like you're there. So, I mean, there's just a lot to be excited about when it comes to this self-driving technology.
How does that change the culture of the road as you discovered it on your little research trip?
If anybody has driven through small town America recently, it's already taken quite a big hit. Like, if you walk on the main street of town after town, you see it's just not the same as it used to be. Like, and this is the effect of decades of, say, you know, Walmart coming in and Amazon, you know, taking out. There's no more small bookstores. There's Amazon, you know. So these small towns are just totally changed. Take a truck stop, for example, and you've got, say, 10 servers in this truck stop. Well, these servers' wages and salaries are based off of the spending that truckers spend. And as soon as you remove the truckers, then there's going to be fewer people eating at these places. There's fewer people going there, which means that these places need fewer employees. So then you've got, say, instead of 10 employees, you can downsize to, say, 5 employees. Well, now these towns have fewer jobs. So then these employees that would have spent their money in other places no longer have money to spend in these other places. So then those places are affected too. So when we're talking about the automation of jobs, we have to remember that there are many effects beyond this that just resound down chain after chain.
When you talk to the truckers, do they fear this technology? Are they skeptical of this technology? There's a lot of truckers I know who couldn't imagine what they do being replaced by a chip.
I've heard both positive and I wouldn't say negative, but just saying that, there's a concern. I mean, if you know about self-driving technology, this should be a concern.
Scott Santons, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Scott Santons writes about and advocates for basic income. He recently wrote about the economic impact of the future of the trucking industry for Medium. And now a classic story. I'm sure you've got one. You're young, you're on your own in the big city. This is 20-something Elian Blue Beck's story.
I moved to Brooklyn. I end up in a 4-bedroom apartment. My rent is $800 a month, which is fantastic.
Now, all roommate stories are not so fantastic, and Elian's takes a turn for the worst in just a moment. But wow, roommate stories. We discovered this is a rich vein of, what do you call it, horror comedy?
Hey, this is Brad from Louisville, Kentucky. My cousin needed a place to live after a traumatic breakup. He stayed with me for 6 months. It was a messy hell. And finally, he ended up leaving when I discovered he'd been storing bodily fluids behind his desk.
Here's one from Chicago. My college roommate was always naked. She didn't care if I was there. She even ate naked. Once I came in and she was eating an entire birthday cake. She told me to stay away from her cake. Yeah, like I want some of your naked cake.
Hi, my name's Lee Tenhove. I'm calling from North Bergen, New Jersey. I once had a roommate who fried eggs in a pan and forgot about them somehow. Put the pan away with the eggs still in it in our cabinet. The smell led us to the source eventually. Another time she covered our entire kitchen, every surface in it, in wax by attempting to melt down candles over the stove. They instead exploded all over the place, and we had to scrape wax off every surface.
We got college roommate horror stories, big city horror stories, bad relative roommate horror stories. And our friend Alien says this is common for a very simple reason.
People move in with their boyfriends, people break up with their boyfriends, revolving door.
New York City. My first roommate brought a pregnant barn cat back to our room. The cat had kittens on my only pair of jeans. She then took the cat, not the kittens, and went home to visit her parents, leaving me with 3 kittens. It is preventing this sort of thing that made entrepreneur Elian Beck crazy to select the right roomie and weed out all the slobs and bad seeds. Because, Beck says,
we cared about who we lived with, and my roommates and I would end up sitting across the table from each other, interviewing people for hours on end.
And so Ms. Beck and a small group of clever, low-rent entrepreneurs in Brooklyn decided to solve this problem. Beck actually ditched her good job at Vanity Fair magazine to focus on this roommate problem full-time. The one-by-one interviewing process, Elian Beck says, just had to go.
It's inefficient. It's awkward. It's highly imprecise.
And so what do people in their 20s who encounter awkward, imprecise, inefficient phenomena, they
build websites.
Build websites, exactly.
Well, obviously.
So that's what we got.
Yes.
RoomZoom is the website dating service to match rooms with roommates.
To match roommates with each other.
Hmm.
We have 2 types of users. One type of user is the user that I was when I moved to New York City and I didn't know anybody. So those types of users are just looking for other people that share a budget and a neighborhood preference and a few lifestyle factors with. And then the second type of user is the user I was when I lived in Brooklyn, when I would have a roommate move out and then need to replace that person efficiently and replace them with somebody who fit in with the vibe of the apartment.
Now, I'm surprised this hasn't been figured out already.
Me too.
Yeah, but that's what a lot of the great ideas are, the thing that should have been invented like 3 years ago.
I'm astonished. I was thinking about this years ago. I actually started the company with 2 of my friends from Tufts, but we knew nothing about the industry. One of them moved to Brazil. One of them's becoming an architect. And I was like, okay, I'm going to work at Vanity Fair. This is going to be built by somebody else, and that's that. And 3 years later, it still wasn't. So I decided to build it.
So you left. I mean, that's a good gig, Vanity Fair.
It was a good gig. It was tremendous.
So the fact that you are dominating this space for now,
mm-hmm.
Either means that Google will just overwhelm you with some app tomorrow.
Right.
Or Google will buy you. right? Or someone like that.
But Google's so not consumer-facing that, I mean, I hope they do, because then I can pay off my student loan debt. So
so either you get bought out or you get a funder, a supporter, a big...
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I actually have a roster of seed investors, and they're highly qualified people who, some of them are in the real estate industry now. They understand that problem on a day-to-day level, that when I went into those pitch meetings with the real estate investors, we didn't have a conversation. They just said, we understand. This makes sense. Let's do it. And I think as we grow, other venture companies and individuals will become interested as well.
You could do roommate matching. You could do people going home from college. You know,
sure.
It's the old ride board thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's an algorithm. And I should mention that it's nothing more than that. I wrote the algorithm.
You did?
Yes. I am not a mathematician. I'm certainly not a software engineer. And I wrote the algorithm based on, you know, I moved in with my first roommate when I was 18 years old. And I'm 29 now. So I have 11 years of roommate experience. And you know, obviously, I spoke to experts and I did speak to people who are mathematicians. But I wrote it.
So 11 years of roommate experience, 2 months of C++.
Not even.
Or some coding.
I did it with math.
Math. Just math.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it spits out a percentage match for each user. So John would log on and you would say, this is my budget. This is my date of birth. This is where I want to live. These are a few lifestyle and personality characteristics. We ask you where you went to school, you know, if you like to be social with your roommates, if you prefer not to be.
TV shows, books, that sort of thing.
We don't ask about that yet. Yeah. I'm trying to keep it short. Mm-hmm. It takes 4.5 minutes to sign up right now. And that seems to be a pretty sweet spot for signups. We have motivated people that really want an account, but it's a lot longer than signing up for Tinder, for instance.
When did you see – what's a story that you can tell that really showed you this works?
Well, my own story, first of all. And my users tend to write and say, I'm having this terrible roommate situation, X, Y, and Z. And now I've logged on and I have 3 or 4 people that are compatible with me because they're moving at the same time I am. They have the budget. A lot of it's logistics. Our community is predominantly 20 to 27. They are artistic. They're educated. They care about who they live with. Everybody who's on Craigslist is not on RoomZoom, and that's because people who are on Craigslist don't care who they live with, and it's okay, and it's going to be random, and it might be a stressful situation, but it's easier.
A discriminating young audience with disposable income.
Not that much disposable income, actually.
But enough.
No. Some of them have disposable income, sure, because we see what their budgets are for renting an apartment. But some of them are scraping by on rent that you cannot imagine people scrape by on in New York City. But the way that they're doing it is by living in a shared living situation. A 4-bedroom or a 5-bedroom apartment ends up being a lot cheaper per person than if you're renting a 2-bedroom apartment in Chelsea.
How many employees do you have?
I have 1 full-time employee and I have 4 interns.
So
all these incredible people want to work for RoomZoom. I can't figure it out.
11 years of roommate experience, not even a few months doing math. What was that college degree thing all about?
International relations and
very
English.
Bad investment.
Yeah.
You're into that for 5 digits or something.
Uh-huh.
Like, yeah.
Oh, it's bad.
Yeah. Well, maybe this will get you over that.
We'll see. I mean, I don't know. It's an interesting time in this world, and I'm excited to be a part of it at this point.
Elian Blue Beck is the founder of RoomZoom, a roommate matching site available so far just in New York City. But Elian says it's coming soon to more cities around the country. And here's something to take with you today. China's media regulator has banned celebrities such as actors and actresses from appearing as presenters on television shows to ensure no improper remarks are made while on air. Sounds like a good idea, according to state news agency Xinhua. That was their report on Monday. TV hosts are responsible for the show, guiding the audience and controlling the pace of the live broadcast, state news agency Xinhua says. Thus, it's unsuitable for guests to be hosts or presenters. You know, I agree with that. That's all for today, but you can join any of the conversations you heard on today's program. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.